to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, July 13, 2020. Sudan amends its 1991 criminal law giving non-Muslims freedom to drink alcohol.
So we commend the step by the current transitional government, and in particular the Minister of Justice and his diligent work to have all the laws code to be consistent with the charter for the transitional period of 2019.
And leaders in Jonglei are calling for a ceasefire.
Our immediate task is to stop the fighting that is going on between the peoples of the communities of Jonglei and Greater Pibor Administrative Area.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's transitional government has amended the country's 1991 criminal law to allow non-Muslims to drink alcohol and cancel the apostasy law that punishes Muslims with death penalty for leaving the faith. A Washington-based human rights activist says the amendments will allow more religious and social freedoms and guarantee women's rights by adopting the Convention on Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio reports from Washington.
Sudanese Justice Minister Nasruddin Abdul Bari announced on national television Saturday the government will enforce new amendments to cancel the death penalty for apostasy. He also said non-Muslims can now drink alcohol in private spaces without fear of prosecution. In a separate statement, Abdul Bari announced that anyone who conducts female genital mutilation faces criminal prosecution. Adlan Ahmed Abdul Aziz, a human rights activist with the U.S.-based organization Sudan Human Rights Network, says the repealed laws were written into Sudan's 1991 penal code under ouster President Omar al-Bashir, but first introduced in 1983 under then Sudanese President Jafar Nimeiri.
So this move now is a big step towards getting out of those laws against human rights, basic human rights, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of all these type of freedoms. So we commend the step by the current transitional government, and in particular the Minister of Justice and his diligent work to have all the laws code to be consistent with the charter for the transitional period of 2019.
In 1985, Sudanese religious leader and trained engineer Mahmoud Mohamed Taha was executed by the Nimeiri administration on apostasy charges after he called for abolishing Sharia law in Sudan. Abdulaziz says the apostasy law was used as a political tool by both Nimeiri and Bashir to limit freedom of religion and to silence their political opponents.
Even within the schools of Islamic thought, people might say, for example, there's the Salafis, which is the fundamentalists. They can say there's the Sufism, or they commit apostasy, or they should be tried, and, even if they are Muslims, but from another school of thoughts. This is used in religion term, in political term, for the purpose of silencing other people from thinking freely.
Sudan's transitional constitution guarantees freedom of religion and worship to all citizens, stating in part, no one shall be compelled to convert to a religion they do not believe in or practice rites or rituals they do not voluntarily accept. Sudan's transitional government also amended a criminal law banning alcohol consumption for all citizens and punishing offenders by public flogging. The amendment exempts Christian citizens from the ban. Abdulaziz says the ban should be lifted for all citizens.
There is a discrimination based on the religious faith. There's no equality before the law. If you apply a law to particular religious faith and do not apply it for the others. This will open the door for the discrimination based on their faith or religious. Should the Muslims carry an identity saying that they are Muslims, and Christians carry also identity saying that? So you open the door for discriminating between people.
Sudan's 2019 transitional constitution, which was drafted after President Bashir's ouster, it states that people are equal before the law and have the right to the protection of the law without discrimination between them because of ethnicity, color, gender, language, religious faith, political opinion, racial or ethnic origin, or any other reason. The Justice Minister also amended a law that previously gave authorities the power to arrest and convict people for prostitution based on suspicion. Under that law, consensual sexual relations outside the marriage were considered prostitution. Abdulaziz says it's a good thing that the article on suspicion of prostitution was thrown out.
It is a vague in the old one, and that's opened doors for many malpractice in the courts, and it give wide authorities to police and to the courts to justify what they think upon their opinion. But the new one, it has a specific definition of what is prostitution.
Abdulaziz says prostitution remains illegal in Sudan, but should only apply to people engaging in sex for money. Sudan's 2019 constitutional document repealed the country's 2005 transitional constitution. The 2019 document states that all laws remain in force unless they are repealed or amended. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Still in Khartoum, some Sudanese women activists have welcomed a recent government decision to criminalize female genital mutilation and making it punishable by 3 years in jail. Some women say the government's decision to enact the Personal Status Act, which allows women to now travel with their kids outside the country without the approval of their spouses, is a positive move. The activists say the new law will save many girls from harm related to FGM practices. For VOA News, Michael Atil reports from Khartoum.
The head of Sudan's Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, last week signed into law a number of bills, including one that criminalizes female genital mutilation. Speaking Saturday on the national television, Sudan's Justice Minister Nasruddin Abdul Bari said the transitional government intends to abolish all discriminative laws left over from former President Omar al-Bashir's era in order to promote equality and democratic transformation. Speaking in Arabic, Abdul Bari said the government wants to promote justice and freedoms for all citizens under the transitional constitution.
The constitutional document came as the result of a long and a deep negotiation, which meant to reflect the aspiration of revolution. It stipulates law reforms that direct the transitional government to carry out responsibilities that secure freedoms and rights for all Sudanese people.
Under the personal status law, Sudanese women are now allowed to travel with their children outside the country without attaining prior permission from their spouses. It also abolishes provisions that demand certain types of clothing indecent and punishable under the law. Women's rights activist and Khartoum resident Suleyma Ahmed Ayub says her 15-year-old daughter could never join her whenever she traveled outside Sudan because her former husband would not allow it.
He banned his daughter from traveling since she was 2 years old in Sudan, and my passport was written wife. They did not write my own name on it. And when he divorced me, I decided to go back for my father's studies. And whenever I wanted to go out or travel anywhere, authorities demanded permission from my husband, even though I was divorced.
Umanas Adam, who hails from Sudan's western region of Darfur, also welcomes the new law. Speaking in Arabic via WhatsApp from central Darfur near Chitty Town, Adam says thousands of Sudanese women lost their lives during labor as a result of FGM practices.
There has been a significant increase on mortality rate among our communities, and most of them are related to the female genital mutilation practices. That is why our society is now aware of this. This law would help in reducing mortality and allows many women to survive.
Ehsan Fagiri, who heads the women's group No to Women Oppression Initiative, also welcomed the amended law. Speaking in Arabic, Fagiri says women have been demanding these changes for years.
We shall continue to demand for laws that give dignity to women and protect women and their kids, and give the rights to the rightful owner. We don't want to see any bias on any side. In any case, a woman is the right person to raise the child more than the husband, even if he is married to a stepmother.
According to the United Nations, 9 out of 10 females in Sudan between ages of 15 and 49 have undergone some of FGM, which can lead to a number of physical and psychological problems. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
The committee formed by President Salva Kiir to address the ongoing intercommunal clashes in Jonglei State is calling on armed youth from Bor, Kobo and the Greater Pibor Administrative Area to cease hostilities. The committee is meeting leaders from the communities involved in the conflict in a bid to find the root causes of the crisis. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
2 weeks ago, President Salva Kiir formed a high-level committee to resolve the ongoing intercommunal fighting between the Lawnuer, Dinka Bor and Murle of the Greater Pibor Administrative Area in Greater Jonglei. The 13-member panel, led by Vice President James Wani Ega, is supposed to conduct meetings with elders from the communities involved in the conflict in order to find peaceful ways to end the violence. Abraham Jong-Aring, who is heading the committee's delegation to Bor, says he has asked community leaders from Bor County to persuade the armed youth to withdraw from the Greater Pibor Administrative Area.
Our immediate task is to stop the fighting that is going on between the peoples of the communities of Jonglei and Greater Pibor Administrative Area. We want immediate stop of the fighting. Number two, we want the communities that are fighting to withdraw back to their original places so that we evacuate the wounded who are in the front line.
Fighting in Jonglei Sakobo and Bor counties and Gumru County of the Greater Pibor Administrative Area has left dozens killed and has displaced thousands of civilians, mostly women, children and the elderly, according to aid workers. Gabriel Denga Jack, the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission Director in Jonglei State, says 405,000 people have been displaced as the result of floods and intercommunal fighting in Greater Jonglei. Ajak says while all the displaced are in dire need of humanitarian aid, it is difficult for humanitarians to respond because the areas are still insecure.
Yeah, it can never be safe when there is conflict. Because the staff are evacuated in people, that is a sign that it was not safe. And we want it to be safe in order for us to deliver the needed humanitarian assistance. So it is not safe at all in those areas out there.
Aring says those areas can only be assessed by aid agencies after the fighting ends.
After all this, when the communities have gone back to their places and stopped fighting, the humanitarian work will start and continue to deliver services to the affected communities.
President Kiir instructed the panel to immediately ensure the safe provisions of relief aid, including food, to the affected communities. Aring's delegation is meeting with community leaders and elders to hear their suggestions on possible solutions for ending the fighting ahead of a visit by Vice President Wani Ega.
And our mission is to come and find from the ground, from the communities, what are the root causes of the conflict, violence that is going on in Jonglei State and Greater Pibor Administrative Area. And what are the recommended solutions to this conflict to resolve this unending conflict between the Murule of Greater Pibor Administrative Area and the neighboring communities of Murule in Jonglé State?
Akeny Ajin Rook, a youth leader in Bor County, welcomes efforts to stop the violence, but says the ceasefire will only hold if the national government provides immediate security to civilians.
If that the youth who have gone to the bushes, we don't have contact with them. Since out of the bush, so we are going to send people to go and look for them, and we are for peace. It is the government also provides security to the civilian of the country. So we need government actually to play the role of its role. And also the reason why the youth are all armed and got their ammunition. Where do they get them from? They don't go to other countries to go and buy them, but they only get them from the government. So it's a government which is not controlling the ammunition of the nation and the arms as well.
The Greater Jonglé region has been plagued for years by recurring intercommunal fighting involving the Dinka from Bor County, the Nuer from Akobo County, and the Murule from the Greater Pibor Administrative Area. The attacks and counter-attacks involved cattle raids, child abduction, and revenge killings. For VOA News, I am Dengai Ding in Bor.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the number of COVID-19 cases continue to increase in the United States. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
why do you think more young people are turning away from farming?
You know, for you to farm, to be a farmer, you have to wait. I'm waiting, and you know, these guys, they don't want to wait. They want the money now. They don't want you to maybe you plant your corn or maize or yam, and you have to wait till probably like how many months before it germinates and before you can even harvest.
Maybe because they feel or they view farming to be an old occupation or vocation that's mostly for the villagers. But then I feel farming is one that I know you can generate money from.
In most cases, young people in Africa think white-collar jobs are the most earning, but in the real sense, it's the reverse.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the coronavirus pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and noses when we are in crowded areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. With more than 3 million cases and over 137,000 deaths, COVID-19 is taking a heavy toll on the United States as the number of new infections continue to rise. As VOA's Ken Farabwa reports, encouraging people to wear masks is becoming a widespread effort throughout the country that could help control the spread of the virus.
At Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin, fans of IndyCar racing gathered by the thousands for the first publicly accessible event since the coronavirus pandemic closed racetracks across the country. Masks were encouraged, but not mandatory.
Yeah, and it's one of the best tracks in the world. So they're taking the precautions. Everyone else is taking precautions. I had no concerns about coming out.
All the staff and drivers and everybody are wearing masks, but I don't think the fans are quite as good about that.
In Florida, one of the states experiencing a surge in new COVID-19 cases, the popular Disney World Resort opened its gates to visitors for the first time in months, with a mandatory mask-wearing policy for most areas of the theme parks.
To the data we have right now, there's no downside to wearing a mask.
U.S. Assistant Secretary for Health Admiral Brett Giroir emphasized masks could prevent further spread of the virus, especially in areas where COVID-19 is on the rise.
It's really essential to wear masks. And for this to work, we have to have like 90% of people wearing a mask in public in the hotspot areas. If we don't have that, we will not get control of the virus.
After weeks of resisting, President Donald Trump wore a mask publicly for the first time while visiting service members and healthcare workers at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in suburban Washington, D.C.
I think when you're in a hospital, especially in that particular setting where you're talking to a lot of soldiers and people that in some cases just got off the operating tables, I think it's a great thing to wear a mask. I've never been against masks, but I do believe they have a time and a place.
In an online question and answer session from 10 Downing Street in London, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson hinted at tougher restrictions throughout Britain as new legislation in Scotland made masks mandatory in shops.
But face coverings, yes, we increasingly think that we've got to be very insistent on, you know, in places, in confined places where you're meeting people that you don't normally come into contact with, transport, shops, wear a face covering.
Medical experts say wearing a mask isn't the only important measure that could stop the spread of infection.
You really got to stop the bars. You've got to decrease restaurant capacity. You've got to physically distance. We have to have people wearing a mask in public. It's absolutely essential. And you've got to use good hand hygiene.
Measures Admiral Giroir and other health officials across the United States hope will curb infections in the country that set records for the most new COVID-19 cases in a single day, several times over the last week. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News.
You're required to wear a face mask in City West Hollywood. No problem. Thank you, sir.
South Africa now accounts for about 40% of all corona cases on the African continent, and the virus is spreading rapidly. On Sunday, President Cyril Ramaphosa addressed his people, begging them to adhere to rules meant to limit in-person contact and critically banning all alcohol sales and imposing a national curfew. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Coronavirus is spreading rapidly in South Africa, a move that has prompted officials to announce a host of new measures and restrictions. Nearly 4 months ago, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced a state of disaster and placed South Africa into one of the world's most restrictive lockdowns, with total bans on alcohol and tobacco and strict measures against movement and travel. Now, 18 weeks after the virus hit South African shores, the normally calm president addressed his nation with a stern countenance.
There are some amongst us who continue to ignore the regulations that have been passed to combat the disease. They also act without any responsibility to respect and protect others. In the midst of our national effort to fight against this virus, a number of people into organizing parties, who have drinking sprees, some who walk crowded spaces without the protection of masks.
And then after the lecture, the consequence.
The sale, the dispensing, and the distribution of alcohol will be suspended with immediate effect. There is now clear evidence that the resumption of alcohol sales has resulted in substantial pressure being put on hospitals, including trauma and ICU units. Most of these occur at night. Therefore, as an additional measure to reduce the pressure on hospitals, a curfew will be put in place between the hours of 9 p.m. and 4 a.m.
Health Department data support the dangers posed by alcohol consumption in South Africa, with Health Minister Zweli Mkhize linking the alcohol ban to a decrease in motor accidents and stabbings. Nevertheless, as Monday dawned, Ramaphosa was hit with swift political blowback. In a statement, opposition leader John Steenhuisen said the ban and curfew distract from the real issue, the utter failure to build treatment and testing capacity. Alcohol industry associations also weighed in, complaining they were given no warning about the sudden prohibition and warning that the industry's 1 million workers could suffer. For Johannesburg wine shop owner Jonah Naidu, Monday morning was a rude awakening. His small boutique wine shop already suffered a major hit during the first 2 months of lockdown, when they were completely shuttered. His shop will faithfully follow the new law, he says, but the prohibition raises some serious questions about how and whether he can stay afloat.
It was a wake up to a hard cold reality of how do we kickstart again? What do we say to the staff? How do we use the staff over this time? How do we keep them busy? Those are the big questions on our minds.
And he argues the ability to purchase alcohol deters from buying illicit alcohol. Anecdotal research shows that illicit sales boomed during the two-month lockdown, and hospital administrators noted a rise in hospitalizations and deaths from home-brewed alcohol. With nearly 280,000 cases and more than 10,000 new cases a day, everyone agrees these are tough times in the Rainbow Nation. That's something Ramaphosa acknowledged at the end of his sobering speech. "We will weather this storm," he said. "We shall overcome." Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Sudan amended its laws on drinking alcohol and repealed a law that punished Muslims for leaving their religion. The government also criminalized the practice of female genital mutilation. Sudanese Justice Minister Nasreddin Abdulbari called to the national airwaves on Saturday to say the government has canceled the death penalty for apostasy and non-Muslims can now drink alcohol in private places without fear of prosecution. Human rights activist Adlan Ahmed Abdelaziz calls the amendments a big step forward for Sudan. As he said, the old laws oppress human rights and freedom of expression. Women's rights activists in Khartoum welcome the changes, including the Personal Status Act, which allows women to now travel with their children outside of Sudan without obtaining approval from their husbands first. The head of Sudan's Sovereign Council last week signed into law a number of bills, including one that criminalizes FGM. Rights activist Sulima Ahmed Ayub says for years her 15-year-old daughter was not allowed to accompany her when she traveled outside of Sudan because her former husband would not give his approval. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Junub Sudan by Metaloro Moses.
Necha talent music, I met a little Moses. Yes, the record behind this. Anina I'll be Kore, Matabal Fizunuk Sudan. Anina I'll be Kore, Matabal Fizunuk Sudan. Anina Bikore, Taban, Mapizo, Gasumanina. Anina Bikore, Taban, Mapizo, Gasumanina. Samakan sakila debada fibele na muatani bikore bikore tapangali sikama file kam ohaya bikam bigasa ulwaja ile sabde sibuya de biga bikore kali abuto mode kanganyan hasa de biga mufelis mederesa tanina uwakil biga mapi Lozena korele abu abu de bifekir sikata sudani Waina agdese kino sila uya jamara Puna saidu anina ye afya nina yu Wedile nina salami telena Rabuna saidu anina ye afya nina yu Wedile nina salami anina Bikore, Matabal Fizunuk Sudan. Anina I'll be Kore, Matabal Fizunuk Sudan. Anina Bikore, Taban, Mapizo, Gasumanina. Anina Bikore, Taban, Mapizo, Gasumanina. Rabuna kani rasulu diktora sanzaka situ ayanta bele tanina te Diktro zali gogali dege bili ya yao kizuru domta bele tanina te Jolal kani nduzi rato dama.
We've been listening to Metaloro Moses with the song Junub Sudan. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
bele de masi win ya kwa na zundu.